Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Okay. Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Hello, you're listening to Interchange on WFHB. I'm your host, Allison Bechtesh. I have here in the studio with me today, John Vickers, the director of the Indiana University Cinema. Welcome, John. Thanks for coming down.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really excited to talk to you for the next hour about the IU Cinema, of course, and the season, but also what went into building such a state-of-the-art cinema, and also your personal connection to it, because it's one of those stories where you're just kind of found a perfect match, and we don't all find that in our careers. So it's very exciting to have you come and share all of that with us. Let me first tell you that in 2010, John was tasked with designing the new IU Cinema from the ground up. Now, in its second season, the IU Cinema hosts scores of film series, lectures with visiting directors and renowned actors. It's definitely been built up very quickly over that time. So that's who we have here in the studio with me. But like I said, the story is a perfect match, and I'm curious about your experience with cinema even from the very beginning. I mean, what are some of your early interactions with going to the movies and seeing films?
Sure. Well, first off, it wasn't a career path, at least as far as I knew when I was starting. Some of my early memories, I loved the Universal monster movies, so the Dracula, Frankenstein, the werewolf, and all of those. And but I think more importantly, I grew up in a small town, and there was not a lot to do, and so the cinema was one thing, you know, that we could do. And I grew up with a lot of Disney fare and family fare, and that was okay. It was entertainment. But I don't think I really got exposed to the things that I like now until late in high school and even in college. And I started going to an art cinema at Michigan State. And I really got exposed to independent film, international film, and more classic film. And I think that was my real introduction to cinema.
Wonderful. And like you said, it wasn't your designated career path. So I definitely want to get to how those nooks and crannies came about. Do you have memories of some of those early films and what they clicked inside you that you could differentiate? Oh, this is different from going to the big theaters and seeing a Disney film.
Yeah, the films at Michigan State. Oh, sure. I think early exposure to early Hitchcock films, like The Lady Vanishes, and Notorious remains one of my favorite Hitchcock films, even though it doesn't make the canons that most of his films do. But I just had fond memories of that film. Other international films, gosh, I saw a lot, and I'm trying to think of what's really clicked. There's one that's really kind of sentimental and film critics bash, but Cinema Paradiso, for somebody that loves film and then eventually went into exhibition, Cinema Paradiso still remains really pretty special in my heart, even though it is sentimental. And anyway, I mean, it's something that really strikes a chord with me because I can relate very much to it.
I actually love that movie. It's funny that you would mention that. I mean, I have the soundtrack on my iPod, and I might tear up in the middle of driving through traffic or something. You're right. It's got that kind of sentimental bit to it, but you can relate. And that goes right into, can we step back just a little bit and talk about the purpose of going to theater, going to see something in a cinema? You know, especially now with Netflix and the internet, you can see a movie that once before was so hard to get or so obscure that you could only see in the theaters. You could see that at home now. What is it about actually being in a theater that makes that a special experience?
Yeah, well, I think there are a number of things, but one is the immersiveness of it. If it's presented well and you're in a dark room and the screen is big and the projection is good, you can really get immersed into a story, and I think that's much more difficult to do at home. There's also the shared experience and the infectiousness of an audience's reaction. So whether it's laughter, whether it's fright or other emotions, I mean, I think that plays into the experience as well. And then I think the experience of going even before and after the film, so sitting in the theater and the anticipation and having social interaction with people and the people that might be running the operation, and then having the conversations afterwards. So all of those things combined, I think, can make a film an experience as opposed to, you know, just watching a movie.
Wonderful. Well, I had a delightful time looking over some of your top experiences from your very first project. You're definitely known around Bloomington as creating the IU Cinema to its current state. But you had been tasked with that once before with your own cinema, the Vickers Theater in Three Oaks, Michigan.
Yes.
Let's start with just how did that project come along?
Sure. Well, I'll start with I was in manufacturing, so I have a civil engineering degree from Michigan State, and I was running a manufacturing company with my brothers, and I continued to love film after Michigan State, so I would rent anything that was obscure at the video stores. But anyway, one day, our small town theater that I had gone to as a child went up for sale. And within, I think, 2 or 3 days, on impulse, I told my wife that we should buy that. We should show interesting films. She was a painter. You know, we should line the walls with her artwork and then live in the old projection booth, which was turned into a small apartment, and live this bohemian lifestyle. And it just sounded like such a romantic, great dream. Well, by the time we bought the theater, again, within that week, and we started rehabbing it. And the process to get it to look like what we envisioned it to look like took us about 2.5 years. So in those 2.5 years, our first child was born, and our second child was about a month away from being born. And so the bohemian lifestyle, I guess you could still live that, but we wanted to be responsible. and so we decided to open the cinema and, you know, keep my day job in manufacturing. And so it was a hobby business. And so we opened on the weekends, you know, 3 days a week. But we did, I think we accomplished everything we wanted to accomplish other than living there and living that lifestyle. But eventually we expanded it to 5 days a week, and we built what was what became a successful art house in a town of less than 2,000 people. And it still kind of blows me away to think of, you know, how that happened. There were a lot of things going for it, which I'll mention in a moment. But sometimes often we would get notices from our distributors that our box office was the best in the country on a Saturday night in this town of, you know, 2,000. And a film that might be playing in 33 cities across the country, Three Oaks, Michigan, had the best box office. And I still really can't believe that that happened. But in this town, there was much less to do. And so we had kind of the only game in town, and we drew from a lot of other areas as well. You know, part of the success, though, that I kind of alluded to was we were situated in a good spot. We were about 5 miles from Lake Michigan, so we had a lot of Chicagoans that had summer homes or weekend homes nearby. And then we were also about 20 miles from a number of three different cities. One was Michigan City, Indiana. One was St. Joe, Michigan. And the other was South Bend, which is the home of Notre Dame. So we had some good communities to draw from within driving distance, which helped.
Perfect. So this is 1994 through 96 that you're creating a theater, and two people who, though, brought a love of cinema, didn't really know what went inside a theater. How did you go about actually building it?
Sure. I mean, we were very naive. And so, I mean, we had designs in our mind of what we wanted the space to look like. We had no idea what the equipment was and you know, how to operate it. And actually, we opened in June of 96, and in March of 96, we had no equipment, but we just knew that we were going to open. So we went to a show out in Vegas called Show West, which has changed names since then. But we saw the equipment, we met dealers, et cetera, and then we found lines on used equipment, and we found some used equipment in Chicago. We bought it, hauled it back, and then we set it up ourselves. We completely set up our own projection booth without really knowing the equipment, and we just figured it out, and we were up and running in June like we hoped.
Wonderful. And you had converted it from a theater to a theater, right? So you didn't have to refurbish or, you know, build all the chairs or a ticket booth or anything like that?
We did. We completely gutted it. So not only did we gut it, but we built balconies. So there were never balconies. We leveled the flooring behind half of the auditorium seating. So we changed it from seating 315 to seating 126, because behind the first so many rows of seats, then we leveled it out and put oak floors, and then we put bistro tables back there so you could, you know, drink your cappuccino or your coffee. But also we did it, I mean, not only for that reason, but we also did it because it never would have met code with all the different angles that were in the auditorium. So we made it completely accessible. And then to create additional wall space for our gallery idea, in that back section, we also then built some catwalks that led to little balconies. So we doubled our wall space for artwork. And I mean, it was very well thought through and probably haunted me every night, you know, for the 2.5 years that we worked on it, trying to figure out how to do the things we wanted to do. But the end result was, I think, one of the most unique little boutique cinemas in the Midwest.
Wonderful. I want to talk about some of the moments that you were able to bring after that, but sure. What was opening night like? I mean, you have a cinema, like you said, in a town of 2,000 people, you turn on the lights and someone can come watch a movie, but was there that moment where it's like, will anyone even show up?
Yeah, well, after 2.5 years, we knew that there was some excitement building, and most of the locals, or many of the locals, everybody had an opinion what it should be, of course, and so showing first-run films was probably the strongest opinion, but that was completely against what we wanted to do. I mean, we wanted to show first-run films, but art films. And but there were some folks that we met along the way that really could kind of maybe even had better, more of a vision than we did. And there was a painter that relocated from Chicago into our town, and he said, you know, this is going to make all the Chicago papers. This is going to make Chicago Magazine. This is going to, you know, really be a hit. And I wasn't thinking that far ahead. I was just thinking that, you know, we're going to live this little naive lifestyle, and people will come if we build it. But to the extent that it succeeded, I really couldn't envision that.
Well, I think a lot of what you established then has made your transition to Bloomington what it was, and I think you were eyed for the position, or chosen, because of the experience. One is that you were able to cultivate these relationships even as a small theater in Michigan, like you said, having the biggest turnout for these films nationwide. How did you go about, I mean, again, as not a film studies major or anything, how did you go about calling the director of a film that you admired and getting it sent to you?
Sure. Well, it's a little more business-like than that. So the first thing to do is you establish your relationships with the studios and the distributors. And that's as simple as an introductory letter saying who we are, how many seats, what our ticket prices are. And it becomes pretty much almost a form, you know, that you're sending to introduce yourself. And then you need to build the trust in them to give you the films. And it usually starts by them giving you something that they can't sell anywhere else. And then eventually you can get, you know, good dates. If you're doing well and performing well, you can get good dates on things that you really want from those distributors. You know, it took time to build the studio, to build the relationships with the studios and the distributors. But one thing that we did that I think was the smartest decision was, you know, many theaters use bookers or booking agents. So it's a middle person to that has the relationships with those studios, and it's easier for them, and they think they can get better dates that way, but we elected not to do that and build those relationships on our own. And that's what's led me, I think, to success, you know, since then. So, you know, building those relationships, I think, has been key. And, you know, one thing that you haven't mentioned is not only from the Vickers Theater, then I went to Notre Dame to open a cinema. So, I think that was probably, that experience was more attractive to IU maybe than the Vickers Theater experience, because I was there for 6 years building a program that was very well integrated into the academy, like we're trying to do here at IU.
Wonderful. Can you talk a little bit about the other things you would do at the Vickers Theaters besides this films or screening with live music and some other live performances?
Yeah, one thing that we're really proud of is we championed silent film for 10 years. So we put on a silent film festival for 10 years called The Sound of Silence. And we would have local musicians or bands create new scores, non-traditional mostly scores for silent film. And it was our way to try to introduce new audiences to silent film. And it grew to where it was a 3-day event, and our biggest festival, I think we had 12 feature films, all with new, you know, world premiere scores. But some of the things, we would always do an outdoor screening or two outdoor screenings in a weekend. And so, you know, having a silent film with live, you know, music outdoors was pretty special. And we had some occasions where it was... I don't know. One of them was probably the single most exciting producing moment for me artistically that I've ever done. And it was presenting a French-Italian version of Cyrano de Bergerac that had been just completely restored and hand-colored. And we presented it with a 26-piece orchestra outdoors. And it had previously played in Paris, San Francisco, and then Three Oaks, Michigan. And I think we had 300 or 400 people outside, and it was really just a special, magical moment, really. And this is film, so this is 35 millimeter. So for this particular one, we needed 2 35 millimeter projectors running changeover, and that's a complicated setup to set up, you know, in one day for an outdoor event.
That's wonderful. So last question before we go into a break here, but I think it again establishes where you are now. This was a family business or a family venture. Not only did you and your wife go into it together, but as you said, you mentioned your three kids were came about during that time and ended up working in the theater too. And the family is a bigger term than even that, as you brought people home to and had these events, you know, and artists come into your home. Can you talk about that connection between your family and the greater family and your work?
Yeah, well, family is important, of course. And our kids did grow up in the cinema, selling popcorn, selling tickets. And actually, our oldest, who's 17 now, was running the projector at 14. So, you know, having that family experience, because we were committed to it and there every weekend, that was very important to have them involved. The broader question of family, our audience, we felt, was our family, some of our closest friends that we have today, our friends that we met through the cinema. And so, you know, building that personal experience, you get attached to people. I mean, you build relationships. And so, yeah, so that was another part of our family. And then I think, I don't know if you were alluding to, you know, bringing folks back, like filmmakers or Bela Fleck. Was that you?
Yeah.
Okay, so we were screening a film that Bela Fleck had produced with his brother about taking the banjo back to Africa. And Bela was doing a small tour with that. And he was performing along with that tour, like one or two songs, but he was late coming to our cinema, and one of our audiences had to leave before he got there, and then the next audience came in. So what he did was he said, if you can find a place for this audience, I'll perform a great set for them. So we brought them into our home, which was a restored loft that my wife and I had built, and we had 100 people in our home, and then Bela Fleck performed, I think, an hour and a half concert, you know, for this audience. And then he was so generous that he signed anything that anybody would bring to them. So he stayed for another hour, you know, signing things, and just a real gentleman. And so anyway, just a magical experience. And hopefully we can duplicate something like that down here.
Absolutely. Well, I think the generosity was on both sides there, and that's why it came together as one of those perfect moments. Again, which you have listed on the Facebook page, some of the good memories of the Vickers Theater.
Yes.
Because it's been sold. You are no longer the owner of that theater. Is it still called that? Did they change the name?
They kept the name, the Vickers Theater. I think it has some goodwill, so I think there's value in that. And they're doing wonderfully. I think, actually, they've had their best... The best two summers that the Vickers Theater has had has been since we handed it over. And so I think the audience continues to grow. And I mean, it's really pretty amazing how well they can do with films. And sometimes films that have been out for a number of months, they still get a great, loyal audience.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to go to a break here. If you have tuned in recently, I'm speaking with John Vickers here in the studio at WFHB on Interchange. Vickers is the director of the IU Cinema. And we're going to get into creating the IU Cinema right after this break.
Support for WFHB comes from Bloom Magazine, a proud underwriter of community radio. You can find out what's happening today, on the weekend, and weeks from now on Bloom's new events calendar at magbloom.com. That's magbloom.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Interchange on WFHB. I'm your host, Allison Bektesh. I have here live in the studio, John Vickers, the director of the Indiana University Cinema. John, again, thanks for coming down and speaking with us on Interchange tonight.
My pleasure.
Well, let's get to it. Right here in our sleepy town, we have the Indiana University Cinema, our very own art house theater, of which there was a little bit of an absence for a while when some of our smaller theaters closed down until the Indiana University Cinema came along. I'm very interested in the process of what went into that. So once you were hired, what was handed your way? What was your initial task?
Sure. What was my initial task? Well, when I was hired, the construction had already been started. So the design had been done, and they were working on the construction of the building. And so I wasn't overseeing, I guess, the construction by any means, but I was viewing the process and I was answering questions and, you know, having input as I could have input. I think probably the key where I had maybe the most input was in the design of the motion picture package. So when the design had been handed over by consultants for projectors, sound system, all of that, then I was able to have input into that. Now, I will say that they had a great company do the design work, a company that does these high-end booths around the country. So what I was adding were tweaks, and then as we were getting closer to installation, then I had a lot more input, I guess, into that part of it. Really, I mean, the task that was handed to me was building the infrastructure of an organization. So we needed to build staffing plans, marketing plans, you know, budgets, development plans, a program, of course, and trying to, you know, build all of that into kind of a functioning organization that was all, you know, basically starting from new. So building the business, if you will, mm-hmm. even though it's an academic venture, building the business is what's really the thing that was handed over that required the most attention.
Okay, and I'll turn to your past just a little bit again here, because as you mentioned, you were running an arts program at Notre Dame as well, encompassing more than just cinema, a theater, and kind of performing arts venue. How did that help when you transitioned to IU?
Sure, that helped immensely. So I was hired actually to open the cinema that was part of a larger performing arts center at Notre Dame in 2004. And so I was the manager and then director of the Browning Cinema. And I did that for 4 years before being promoted to managing director of the entire facility. We had five facilities, four of them performance facilities, and then the cinema. And we had a staff of 24. I mean, it was really a well-run, larger operation. And so eventually I was managing day-to-day operations of everything there. Other than the programming and the marketing of the performing arts side, I had my hand in everything else. And so that gave me, I think, great administrative experience of managing all of those other things, including facilities and scheduling and tech and all of those things. But more importantly than that, the experience at Notre Dame in programming the cinema, it was very clear that the Academy wanted to be involved. And so there were many eager partnerships, and I was a willing partner. And so I started taking on a lot of those partnerships because I thought they brought interesting things to the table. And so we started doing a lot of partnerships across the Academy at Notre Dame. And I think that was probably one of the things that was most attractive from IU, is looking at, you know, what you can do with the cinema and make it academically relevant. So I think, you know, that really kind of added to that added greatly to the experience that's helped us here.
Wonderful. There's an article online from someone who holds a similar position to you at the University of Colorado and had the opportunity to come to Bloomington and see the cinema. And he really stressed how important it is to have that support from the institution, that the University of Colorado is not really offering him that. But he's seen here at IU all the way up to President McRobbie really supporting the film department. How important is it that high up administration is behind you on this?
I think it's critical. First off, a single screen art house theater is a horrible business model. So if you were to try to do this as a business, it's a struggle. And so without that subsidization, without, you know, some support from the administration, it would be impossible to have the kind of diverse program that we have. So we might be able to get by showing very commercial art house fare like many art houses do. But to really build a diverse program, you need support. And my feeling, and I think, you know, our model is a unique model really across the country. And I think, you know, maybe a new model, if you will. But I think to look for that support, then you need to give something back. You need to be relevant. And so for us to justify a university budget, I think that we need to make sure that we can show that we're doing academic programming and we're doing things that are worthwhile and hopefully irreplaceable, so we never go away. And so we do that by dedicating half of our program to these academic partnerships. But to speak to Pablo's comments in that article, you know, we are so lucky to have the president and the provost behind this and truly vested in this project. So I don't know if your listeners know this, but the Little Theater, or the University Theater, which where we're housed, was the place for student stage productions from 1941 until 2001. And then there was a new theater and drama building built. And then the Little Theater was pretty much mothballed until 2007, when President McRobbie said, IU does an amazing job of supporting the arts, and this was when he was being inaugurated, and has great facilities for great programs, except for film. And we need a facility for film. We need a place for film. And so he took the lead, and then it was very smart strategically to have this position or this program report directly to the provost, as opposed to reporting through any college or any school. That way we can service the entire university. So really it was well-structured and well-thought through in the beginning, and I think set up to really service the university well.
All right, I want to geek out a little bit about what is actually inside that theater, since you brought it up, obviously converted from what was a live stage theater. So what do we got in there? What's the equipment? What's the experience like to go and see a movie there specifically?
Well, we hope the experience is good, but I'll talk about the equipment first. So we have reel-to-reel 16 and 35 millimeter film projectors. So we can show with changeover, and I'll explain that very briefly in a moment, but we can run reel-to-reel 16 millimeter film or reel-to-reel 35 millimeter film. Now, reel-to-reel is kind of the old-fashioned way where the projectionist changes the reels every 20 minutes, and if he does or she does so well, then the audience never sees it. The key there is, if we didn't have reel-to-reel equipment, we could not get film prints from any of the archives. And so now that we have this equipment and this way of showing films, and then with our booth practices, we can get film prints from any archive in the world. And so we've already had film prints from the British Film Institute, the National Archive in Australia, the Polish Film Institute, plus the Academy Archives here, the Library of Congress, and on and on and on. So we have access to the rare and the good stuff. Very important. Then we also then have the best in digital cinema equipment. So most art houses that are being converted to digital cinema, which is, you know, many these days, can barely scrape together enough money for a single projector. Well, the university chose to put two projectors in. So we have a 4K Sony projector, and we have a 2K Barco projector with the Dolby 3D. And the reason the two projectors were chosen, because they each have attributes that are better in some areas than others. And so to have the very best in digital cinema technology, these two projectors combined accomplish that. And so amazing, and you could think frivolous, but really not. I mean, we can claim that we do have the best means of showing digital cinema. And then the booth is also outfitted with every broadcast quality playback deck, so HD Cam and DigiBeta and Beta SP and HD Cam SR. So every high quality playback deck that you would find in a TV station is in our booth as well. And so all of those things combined, plus on top of that, going through THX certification, all of that combined makes it what we think is the best equipped university cinema in the country. And I would argue that it's in the top 0.1 percentile of any cinema in the country. So out of the 40,000 screens, you know, I think we're in the top 0.1 percentile of any of those screens.
That's amazing to have that right here. I'm not going to let you get away with just naming all those projectors. I want to know more information.
Okay,
so
sure.
You said the 4K is different from the 2K. First of all, what does that stand for, and what are you getting out of each of them?
Sure. So the 4K Sony projector at the time of installation was the highest resolution projector on the market. So the 4K is 4,000 lines per inch, I believe. And so that had the highest resolution of any projector on the market. And there are many 4K projectors, Sony projectors around. However, Sony's 3D option is not ideal for screens that also want to show 2D because it requires a different screen that somewhat mutes your image when you're showing 2D. So the Barco projector that we have at the time was the brightest projector on the planet, 30,000 lumens. And then it also has the Dolby 3D, which was considered the best 3D option on the out there.
In the universe.
So anyway, maybe I'm going to extremes, but combined, those things together really gave us the best. Now, to date, you know, most films are still released in 2K by the studios. However, there are restorations being done in 8K, 6K, but 4K is the highest resolution format that a film can be released in today. Now that's going to continue to change probably, but anyway, and we hope to continue to change as well. So we want to continue to stay leading edge and raising funds to continue to do that.
Wonderful. And then you mentioned the THX certification. What steps do you have to go through, and how do you pass to get certified?
Sure. You pass by final testing. However, the steps you have to go through is THX gets involved from the design process on. So they work with the architects, and they approve all the design, so how things are going to work acoustically, and then the materials that you're using acoustically to isolate and control bounce back or any kind of reverberation, as well as approved set of equipment. So there's an approved equipment list. And then once that's all approved and once it's designed and built out, then they come out and they do testing, and they tweak your system as well. So they put a series of microphones around your auditorium, and they analyze your room. And usually they make adjustments, and then they'll move the microphones and do it again and again and again. And finally, you have a room that should be tuned. And if it's tuned and it meets their specifications, and then it's approved. But they go into measuring HVAC noise and things about the room as well. So they want to make sure that the room is of a high enough quality that should be considered THX certified.
I know I see the letters THX before most movies I go see. How frequently is a theater THX certified?
Yeah, well, every year. So you have to recertify every year. So you have to go through that testing process. But I will say that currently, there are only two THX-certified cinemas in the state of Indiana. So one of them is IU's, and the other one is Notre Dame's. and there may have been others in the past, but maybe they let their certification lapse. And I think there are about a dozen THX-certified cinemas on university campuses across the country. So we're thrown into an elite class by this certification. Whether that means we're the top 12 cinemas in the country, it doesn't. But to go through that process, you do have to meet certain standards. So that immediately eliminates, a lot of the competition.
Are there any other certifications or specific things about the IU Cinema that you don't find in just any old theater?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mentioned the reel-to-reel. And so there's only a smaller percentage of cinemas that run reel-to-reel. I mean, anybody that wants to show archival film has to go that route. But also, we have, I think, 7 or maybe 8 lenses per projector. So we can show every aspect ratio in their proper format or the proper aspect ratio. So, silent aspect ratio, early Academy ratio, 166, 177, 185, and some of your audience members might know what that means, or 239. So every format, as things changed over the years and the way films were shot and presented, we have the ability to represent them in that format. So most theaters that are still running film, most multiplexes that are still running film, and that's not a bash, have only 2 lenses. And so if you got a film in a different aspect ratio, you would either be cropping top and bottom or cropping sides to show it.
Now, you said a lot of the plans were underway by the time you came to the theater. I'm curious if there is like a master dream list that you were able to check off, or if certain things did have to be compromised for money or space, or that equipment just doesn't exist anymore, things like that.
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, of course. There's one big one, and it was more of a space constraint. So we would have loved to have been able to be equipped for 70 millimeter okay. as well. And so that if 35 millimeter is 35 millimeters wide, 70 is twice that. And, you know, 70 millimeter was used mostly in movie palaces. We're not a huge movie palace. And it would probably be overkill for our screen, but to be able to screen 70 millimeter would have been fantastic. However, if we were going to screen 70, we wouldn't have been able to screen 16. And 16 is very important to us because Indiana University has 82,000 reels of film in 16 millimeter. They have this enormous film collection that is ran by the Indiana University Libraries Archives or Film Archives. And it's a little known fact that there are this many, you know, this film holding here, but it's an incredible collection. A lot of educational film, but there's also a lot of feature films. And I mean, it goes across a lot of different types of collections, but there's this great collection here that we can choose from and program from. And so that's very important that we can honor that.
And you mentioned that you can really, because you're not associated with one department, you can show these films or partner with all the different academic branches at IU and all the different schools. Before the cinema came around and was refurbished a couple of years ago, what was happening to those films? Are there other opportunities on campus to watch a 16 millimeter feature film?
Even if they were portable. So some of the mm-hmm. classrooms, I think, had some 16 millimeter projectors. And then there were some actually grad students programming series out of that collection. So there was a City Lights film series, and then there was an Underground film series, which we've brought now under our wing, and they still program. So grad students still program, mm-hmm. you know, parts of our program. So they were being shown, and I think they were getting some audience for those, but it was on maybe a less regular basis than it is now. But then the rest of the partnerships, I mean, there are many, many film series across campus still that are outside of the IU cinema. And so we can't support everyone and every program, so we support what we can. So there might be a film series that we're doing two or three films in partnership with, and they might have another five or six outside okay. of the cinema. So I think we're trying to build and honor as many of those partnerships as we can, but we can't do it all.
I want to know about as many of those partnerships as we have sure. time for when we come back. Before we go to break again, though, tell me a couple of the other things that have nothing to do with actually watching the movie that people get to experience when they come into the theater, some of the artwork and posters that they get to see.
Sure. Well, first I'll talk about the space because it's amazing. And I think it's one of the most aesthetically beautiful and unique cinemas that I've ever been in. So the architects did a fantastic job of maintaining the feel of a 1930s or 1940s auditorium by hiding all of the technology in the room. So when you come in, there's a grand drape, you don't see the screen, and you don't see any of the 14 surround sound speakers that you would see in another auditorium because they're hidden in custom designed light fixtures, et cetera. But then to top it all off, we have four Thomas Hart Benton murals that are part of his Indiana mural series. So we have these beautiful 1930s Benton murals in the auditorium that have been beautifully restored as well. So all of those things. And then I guess I'll add that the color scheme is dark and rich, but it's informed from the palette of the Benton murals. So every color that you see in the entire auditorium, including the seats, were found in the mural palette. And so really, they really complement, I think, and highlight those murals as well. So it's just, it's a beautiful space. It's a warm space to be in. It also has a lot of volume or a lot of height for as small of an auditorium as it is. So it feels grand, even though it's a relatively small auditorium. And then posters, we do have posters for upcoming films, but we also custom design posters for our film series. And so we have some great volunteer designers, and we think that we present the artwork and the posters, you know, for the films pretty well.
And some artifacts as well downstairs?
There are some artifacts, yes. We have an old light fixture in there, but it's a stage light. But then also, we have an exhibition space where we try to put in materials, usually movie-related materials, press books, et cetera, of things that relate to our program. So the cases have been approved for archival materials. So we often have materials from the Lilly Library or the Kinsey Institute or other places on campus.
Okay, wonderful. Well, we do have to go to a break. I'm speaking with John Vickers, the director of IU Cinema, here on Interchange this evening, and we're going to come back and talk all about this upcoming season. Stay with us.
Support for WFHB comes from Darn Good Soup on the west side of the Courthouse Square. Darn Good Soup is open from 11 a.m. to 7:30 p.m., serving 10 to 12 soups daily, plus salads and baked goods. Vegetarian and vegan options abound. Darn Good Soup, it's fast, it's healthy, it's darn good. Online at darngoodsoup.com.
Welcome back. This is Interchange on WFHB. I'm your host this evening, Allison Bektesh. I have here in the WFHB studios with me John Vickers. He came down from the Indiana University Cinema Director there. And we've talked about your upbringing in the world of cinema and what it took to get the program started over there. And I want to close out the hour just talking about what people can see at the IU Cinema this year and perhaps in the future. A lot of big programming going on. I mean, I want to bring up that it took you two years to go from buying a theater to opening nights the first time you did this. You had a couple tries, and now within 2 years, you're bringing huge names to this cinema. I mean, the path has definitely gone exponentially faster and well in your way to being one of the nationally known cinemas in the country. Can you talk about some of the big names that you've already brought in from the last season, and who's going to come visit Bloomington this year?
Sure, sure. Well, I think it's all relative, too. So big names to people that love film are one thing, but big names in the general public are still another thing. So, yes, I mean, we're very proud of everybody that we've brought in, whether they're recognizable or not. So some of the folks, I guess, that we've brought in the past that have been fun to bring in that people might recognize, John Sayles, independent filmmaker, truly independent filmmaker, was great to have in. Peter Bogdanovich was great to have, another good guest. Paul Schrader, who is probably best known as Martin Scorsese's favorite screenwriter. Mm-hmm. So he wrote Taxi Driver and Raging Bull and others, but he's also a great director in his own right as well. We had Jill Godmilo, who's a really strong documentary filmmaker as well as a fictional filmmaker. I don't know. I think we've had about 30 guests so far. Charles Burnett, Pedro Costa, the list kind of goes on from the first season. So it was really, we thought it was a really great grouping of art house and non-art house guests. And that leads us to, I guess, the semester.
And let me interject. So, and sure. That's kind of mining these relationships that you had made in the past and telling these old contacts, hey, I've got a new place for you to come and speak. What brings them in here?
Yeah, well, it's a combination. I mean, some of them are folks that I've hosted in the past, and then others are folks that I've admired in the past as far as their work. And, you know, hooking them to come here really to the middle of Indiana that never had a cinema before has been a challenge. And And I will say that we invite, you know, well over, you know, two times as many guests as actually come. So, you know, we've invited everyone from Terrence Malick to Brad Pitt to Martin Scorsese to, you know, many, many other folks that either haven't responded or have politely, you know, turned us down. So, I'm not saying that we've settled for who we have, because we really appreciate the folks that we've brought in, but we just keep throwing it out there and we keep introducing ourselves. And every semester we have more to show for who we are and what we've been accomplishing, and that to show folks that we take this seriously and we present things well. And we've had great compliments from directors that we can show that we're going to present your work very well here. So anyway, we're building our case, or we're building, you know, our base. And so all of those things lead to, I think, more successes like this semester.
Absolutely. Well, so I wanted to, you know, maybe bring up a couple of the series that you are showing this semester, and pulled up the list, and there's got to be 40 film series, you know, listed here. And so without touching on every single one, can you talk about even curating the series and the partnerships that go into making all these different series happen?
Yeah, it's a puzzle, certainly. And I think your list has maybe some leftover series from previous semesters. But so they're not quite 40, but there are quite a few. And yes, it's quite a puzzle. And what we do is we have our meetings for our academic partnerships early on, so early in the semester for the next semester. And we determine what we're going to support in those partnerships first. But probably either simultaneously or even before that, we've been throwing out invitations to filmmakers that we want to bring here. So those are the two really major pieces of the puzzle that we try to put together first. I'll articulate a little bit better in a few moments, and then there are other things that are ongoing, like the City Lights film series that's programmed by grad students, and the Underground film series, and some of the things that we want to continue to bring every semester. You know, we know that those are going to fit into place as well. So, you know, once we have kind of a general pool or idea of what we want to put in, then we start trying to find dates for things. And as you kind of alluded to, the partnerships are the most difficult, because we need to find dates that are going to work for our partners. We also need to find dates that we can get the films, because some of these films there might be limited prints for, or some of these films aren't even available, so we have to go to alternate titles. So piecing together dates and all of that together it requires a lot of email.
And you're the curator of these. Do you actually get to watch any of these beforehand, or is it a lot of reading reviews and just knowing your film history?
Yeah, it's a combination of both, but anything that we try to program, we try to pre-screen. Now, the reality of that is sometimes we have to trust our partners, because some of the films that our partners bring to the table, you know, sound great, they're by noted directors, or maybe not even, but we have to trust, you know, those partners. And so there are many of the partnered screenings that I may not have seen the titles. Okay. And some of them, I might not have the ability to see the title, because some of these are, I mean, there are two Polish films in our series this year that aren't available in the States. And we're going to actually premiere new digital restorations of these films. So, you know, some of the things I can't see. But it's always good for a programmer to go into an audience knowing what you're showing them, because if there's anything that you need to alert them to, it's best that you can do that in advance. And because if you don't, you run the risk of losing the trust of your audience. And I want to just touch on that just for a moment before we go on. I think for a program to build success and to build an audience on an ongoing basis, it's a matter of trust. And so somebody needs to curate and pull together a program that might not be to everybody's liking, but at least we're letting them know what's there. And hopefully then they'll have the trust to you know, try something that they might not know. And so trust is a really key part of all of this. And I think that's the curator's job, or one of the curator's jobs, is to build that trust and know the program. So if you're presenting things that you don't know, then you're in trouble.
And have you found that you have gotten that kind of audience where people, they don't know the film, they didn't even look up the name, they just show up because they know there's going to be something there on a Friday night that's going to be interesting, or at least conversational?
Yeah, I think, yeah, much of our audience may be unfamiliar with some of the things that we're showing, and they do show up because they're starting to build that trust. I will touch back on the Vickers Theater, and that happened on a weekly basis. We would get people driving 60 miles sometimes, no matter what we screened, because of that trust. And so it's very important. There was actually a great conversation on this listserv that I'm part of about it's all art house programmers. And talking about the new Obama 2016 movie, and it was doing so well that, you know, many art houses were starting to program it. And I don't want to get into the politics of it, but putting it on screen purely based on the economics is a bad decision for a programmer if you haven't viewed it yourself. And if you know your audience and you know that it's going to be something that the core of your audience is going to reject, you know, long term, that could be a poor decision. And again, you know, politics aside, you just need to know what you're putting in front of your audience.
Absolutely. So do you have to balance out some of these big box office? I mean, I guess that's in quotes for an art house film to be a big box office. But you said this earlier in the program that the academic films are just as valuable, even if they don't have those big names or those big draws. And you, because you have this umbrella of a university and all the support, you're able to bring in just the films that are important, not just the ones that are entertaining. So how do you balance those out?
Yeah, balance is the right word. So, right, we need to balance a lot of different things in our program. One of them is the economics. So we do need to bring in things that we think are going to draw in an audience, and not only for the sake of those ticket sales, but also because it's bringing an audience that might not come on a regular basis. So we need to expand and make at least a portion of our program pretty accessible, and, you know, things that they might have heard of before, and it might have had some TV ads, et cetera. So we need to make sure, as long as they're good films, we need to make sure that we're offering kind of a variety for our art house. And so balance is what I want to talk about just for a moment. I know we have a number of stakeholders for what we're trying to do as a program. One of them is being academically relevant. One of them is being Bloomington's art house. And a third, I'll say, is we're trying to build a film festival experience on an ongoing basis. So we're trying to take all of those things and maybe many others, but those, I think, are three of the cores of what we're trying to accomplish. And to me, some of the best experiences at a film festival are bringing things that nobody's seen, so it's something that's fresh and maybe sneak previews or, you know, things like that. But also the filmmaker experience. Mm-hmm. I think the best film festivals bring in a lot of filmmakers, and having that engagement with the audience is key. And so that's a very important part of our program. So I would say those are the three main cores of our program. And then, you know, there are many other things like, you know, having a good solid repertory program and, you know, other things, having things for kids. And but when you talk about balance, then, so we're trying to balance those things, but we're also trying to balance, do we have enough female voices? You know, do we have enough, are we representing the world well enough? And so trying to, you know, fit enough of that into our program also requires quite a bit of balance and just being conscious of those things. And, you know, we're trying to do a lot, and we can always be criticized for not doing enough of something. And so maybe we don't have enough comedies in this year's program, or maybe we don't have enough classic Hollywood. We take all of those criticisms, and, you know, we keep them in our conscience, and then next time, you know, try to maybe find places for more of those.
And you said Bloomington's art house, and I would agree with you that, you know, with the loss of the Von Lee and even the Ryder films have scaled back. Are you able to look at yourself as a community service and not just an academic service?
We are, yeah. Again, I think that's definitely part of our program. And I think the university, well, all great universities have great outreach programs or great engagement programs with the community. And part of the IU Cinema is engagement with the Bloomington community. There's no question about that. I will comment on the Ryder program, and so we do partner with the Ryder film series, and they're our sponsor for our International Art House series. And I think Peter at the Ryder is doing maybe even more programming than he has in the past, and I think he's getting good audiences. So we're very proud to be partners with the Ryder, and that we're coexisting together, and I think we complement each other in many ways.
Wonderful. Yeah. Talk about some of the opportunities for the students, though, because the cinema's here. Are there IU film students who get to learn to use a reel-to-reel projector when they never would have, or get to screen and help curate at all? Does it offer them the opportunity to follow in your footsteps?
Yeah. Well, we do have grad students that are projectionists. We have many house managers that get experience of seeing how the business side is ran. And with that, not only our house managers, but our volunteers often get to meet the filmmakers that we're bringing in, which is great. On the production side, every semester we dedicate at least 3 days to presenting student work. So we're presenting student work on screen, including 3D work, through all of this new technology. And, you know, students are walking away with films packed and ready to go to where they could be, which what that means is they could be taken to any digital, any cinema around the country that's been converted to digital cinema and play their film. So they couldn't do that in the past. So anyway, we're trying to offer those experiences. But one of the other neat experiences that we've done with film students is we've paired film students with music composition students. And we have this program that's going into its second year called Double Exposure, where composition students and film students are creating on the front end what a project's going to look like, and they work together throughout. They end up with a final project with a new score, and then we premiere it with a live orchestra. And so things like that, I think we're offering some very, very unique student experiences in the cinema, thanks to the great faculty that are willing to work with us.
Well, we're getting near to the end of the hour, and I know I haven't, as I said I would, ask you about some of this programming, but I also know that people can go online and look it up, and I encourage them to do so, because I want to talk, as we close out the hour, about some of your bigger ambitions or where the IU Cinema might go from here. I mean, you just talked about the fun of film festivals, which I would agree, and I don't know if maybe a Keystone Film Festival is on the horizon, but definitely you've mentioned that your aim is to have this be a nationally recognized cinema, that it is one of the premier cinemas, both for its content and its ability to show that content. So can you talk about the bigger goals?
Sure. So as you mentioned, yes, we want to be recognized as one of the best facilities in the country, as well as one of the best programs in the country. And we've set benchmarks for both, actually. And so we want to be recognized like the Harvard Film Archive or the Gene Siskel Film Center in Chicago or UCLA's program or even commercial cinemas like the Film Forum or BAM. Mm-hmm. In New York. So we're trying to build a reputation of having this quality curated program on an ongoing basis. And I know that we're getting close to actually making some inroads there. The facility's there. We've been given the facility. So as long as we keep it up and we present well and have good practices, you know, I think we're there. As far as other major things, of course, we want to continue to grow in the types of filmmakers that we bring here and maybe the notoriety of the filmmakers that we bring here. One of the things that's on our strategic plan is to eventually have a filmmaker in residence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, once or twice a year have filmmakers here working with faculty teaching film. So that would be fantastic if we can pull that off. We'd love to do some great outdoor screenings on campus, you know, potentially even in the arts quad around the auditorium and the museum, and have this great piazza type of feeling to some outdoor screenings in the summer. And there's many more things. I'd love to, we commissioned a student to write a score for a feature-length silent film. And we would love to continue that program and offer that opportunity on an annual basis, but then take it a step further and publish it and match it with a DVD and a published film score. But to take it even a step further, to build a national tour. So as it goes around the country, it's carrying IU's name with it. And those are all things that I know that we can accomplish. Those are a few.
That's how's wonderful. That? And again, I know we're headed right up to the end of the hour. More questions than time. So let's do talk about one highlight, Werner Herzog coming to Bloomington. What's that about? And any other highlights you want to throw in? We got about a minute.
Okay. So with the partnership of the Patton Foundation, we're bringing Werner Herzog here to spend 5 days with us. And he has, I think, 7 public events, including 2 major lectures, 4 film screenings he'll be present for, and then many, many private events with students and faculty and staff. But then we also have some other really great international directors like Claire Denis, a fantastic French female filmmaker, Brazilian filmmaker Walter Salles, and we're showing 3 of his road films, which then we're also going to have a sneak preview of the new On the Road film with him here, which is fantastic. We have Todd Salons, a great independent filmmaker that makes very challenging films, but we're excited about that. And many others. I think we have like 6 or 7 other guests coming. So we think we have a great lineup. And then we're also doing some digital restorations. So we're going to show off our digital equipment with some new classic restorations of classic films. And so I think there's something in the program for everyone, no doubt.
Wonderful. Well, we are at the end of the hour. I've been speaking with John Vickers, who is the first director of the IU Cinema. He came down to speak with us on Interchange today. One thing that's mentioned over and over about you is that you're so dedicated to this job and that you can be found when people go to just on any given evening to go watch a film. You're usually there. So I'm going to go ahead and say it's okay to cut off here because we're at the end of the hour, because people can find you at the IU Cinema and grill you then. I really appreciate that you came down to WFHB to talk about the cinema. People can go online and see the entire season set up there and find out what's showing next. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Interchange on WFHB. I'm your host, Allison Bechtesh. Today's show was engineered by Lewis Malone, and our original theme music is by Jamil Effiam.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.